And I'm glad to see that there are folks here who care and who believe change is possible, and that are many of you working to create change in the world. And one of the folks who I think is really doing an outstanding job along those lines by writing and reporting on the truth very fearlessly is the author that we're here to talk about tonight and to celebrate. I'm very, very happy he's here. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Greg Palast.
I don't have a cowboy hat, so I have to wear this because it's a proud moment for America.
We got him. Zarqawi.
We're not supposed to get too, president was told not to get too excited about it. Or act like a cowboy. Yeah, we got him. How did we get him? Who invited him in? April 27th, 2003. Jay Garner sitting in Saddam's bedroom. He just arrived in Baghdad. But things were pretty good. This is the viceroy that we'd put in place, General Jay Garner. And things are good. He was holding a big tent meeting of the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Kurds, and they were ready to go because President Bush had brought him in to Iraq. He'd read it, he'd heard it from the president, to bring democracy, which he thought had something to do with letting them vote. So he called for a vote, that there'd be a vote within 90 days and America would move its troops out. He unpacked his bags and got a call from Rumsfeld, "Don't unpack, Jack. You're out." See, because elections and removing the troops within 90 days, that had to do with elections, but not democracy as Bush and Rumsfeld saw it. See, the elections were not part of the plan. The plan. Contents confidential should not be reproduced or distributed. I can't show it to you. Hold that thought, the plan. Garner packed his tent up, and he was replaced quickly by... Garner had several years of experience in Iraq. He'd ended the fighting in the northern zone. Iraqis knew him, he knew Iraq, but a guy much more qualified was put in his place. Never seen Iraq, but his was far more qualified, Paul Bremer, because he had been managing director of Kissinger Associates. Immediately came in, fired, eliminated all the Baathists, as you call them, so it was de-Sunnification, got rid of the Sunnis, and then moved troops into Najaf, shut down their papers, and pretty soon our war president had a war. The Sunnis had a defender who came in named Zarqawi. Bring him on. And they did. The plan. Ah! That's conspiracy nut stuff. That there was a secret plan. I know some of you thought that there was a secret plan for the oil fields of Iraq, even before the tanks rolled. You're wrong. All right. The plan. Remember that thought. Don't let me forget about the plan. November 3rd, 1 a.m. Most important, I want to hear a big up for Jerry Quickly. I want to hear a big up for a station manager, Eva George, for Christine Blasdale. And I want a special thanks. I want to recognize a couple people who are here, very important to me. Great journalists, Roger Trilling, Ed Rampell. Please identify yourself. And I got some people, by the way, who helped me with the ARM Madhouse and Best Democracy Money Can Buy audiobooks. Alexandra Paul, Brad Friedman, astonishing Brad Blog Friedman, Shiva Rose, and thanks for the sponsorship not only of this station but of the Our Madhouse tour to Progressive Democrats of America and to Operation Rainbow Push and Jesse Jackson for putting the Our Madhouse class war boot camp on the road. Well, let's get to work. Jesse gave me a job to do today, and he said, show them this. Exit polls, 1:05 in the morning. Ohio, state of Ohio. These are CNN's balls, in case you've never seen them. Don't miss, come on. It says, there's two balls. It says, Kerry won among males by 51% to 49%. However, among females, Kerry won 53% to 43%. And that's how Bush won Ohio. I had to explain that to a British audience. So I was the reporter. I worked for BBC Television, nightly news, reporting on the election. So I declared, so I had to report the election results, and I declared Kerry won. But he wouldn't be inaugurated. Now I had to explain this to a British audience and to a world audience. And it took a great deal of time on television. We explained it. You saw that on your television, right? So, no, I did report. Kerry won. And the New York Times called me, the paper of record. They were going to investigate. They want to call me. Why? Kerry won. Said, we want the evidence. We want to investigate this. John Kerry won? Okay, we have a couple of questions. This is New York Times. Question one, Mr. Palace, are you a sore loser? I said, I don't care which rich white guy wins. Question two, are you a conspiracy nut? That always gets a laugh, you know, from the conspirators. Question three, there was no question three. That was the end of the New York Times investigation by the paper of record of the 2004 vote. And they reported their results the next day, I'm not kidding you, a headline, front page of the New York Times, Internet Theories of Bush Loss Spread by Blogs, Easily Debunked. How's that? Well, I guess I could go. Except BBC told me that's not that. Your report's not over, Mr. Palast. What about the balls? CNN's balls. Kerry wins by 2% among men and by 6% among women. All right, class, what's the third sex that put Bush over? The answer, by the way, after 4 years of investigation, by the way, leading before this race, is the disappeared, the uncounted. I'm going to tell you something about American democracy that Mrs. Gordon didn't teach me at Poly High in the Valley. Okay. Look at Ohio. George Bush won, according to the official announcement by Kenneth Blackwell, the Secretary of State. He had won, Mr. Bush, by 118,000 votes. Impressive, not counting 1/3 of 1 million votes never counted. Cast, not counted, and blocked. That's Ohio. You know, that's Ohio. I've been to Ohio. Now, how about America, which surrounds Ohio? In America, in November of 2004, 3,600,380 votes were cast and never counted. 3.6 million votes cast, never counted. Not in Uganda, not in the Ukraine, in the United States of America, cast, not counted, 3 million votes. Oh, this didn't come from, you know, my black helicopter, you know, dropping this stuff on me. This came from digging through the data of the U.S. Census Bureau and the United States Election Information Agency's Reporters Take Note. Rule one of investigative reporting came from Yogi Berra, who said, "It's amazing what you see when you look." And see, at BBC, I'm paid to look. Now, how do you uncount the vote? Where do they go? Well, they're in two big piles. Most of it's two big piles. The first pile is the spoiled votes. 1,389,231 ballots spoiled. Now, how do you spoil a vote? You leave it out of the fridge? I mean, look, hanging chads, remember those? They still hung around from 2000. Punch cards that don't punch, touch screens that don't feel you know how to touch them anymore. Glitches. It happens in any machine. Glitches, glitches, glitches. 1,389,231 glitches. Ballot disqualified, destroyed, uncountable, uncounted. Who gets glitched? That was my question. See, after escaping from the valley, I took statistics. I was a professor of statistics for a long time. And I wish I wasn't, because then I wouldn't know this. Who gets glitched? I'm going to show you something. See, see the little white lozenge on this chart? Okay. That's the number of white voters who get glitched, whose vote simply didn't register in the machine for some reason. It's a lot of them. That is, it's 1.5%. That's a lot of votes. Don't kid yourself. Now look at this big, thick black line. This is the number of the percentage of African American voters who get glitched. Okay? If you are a black voter in America, the chance that your vote will be eaten, mangled, lost, uncounted is 900% higher than if you're a white voter. If you're a Hispanic voter, the chance your vote will get lost, uncounted, technically evaporated, is 500% higher than if you're a white voter. I did this, by the way, with the statisticians of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Okay? And if you're a Native American voter, you'll see that's important. Because when their non-count is like 2,000% higher than if you're a pale face. Okay. Now, you remember your high school algebra, you know, 900x plus 500y plus 2000z equal, you know, et cetera, right? And for those of you whose behind was not left, figured out. 88% of the ballots in the electoral garbage can, 88% of 3.6 million ballots are cast by minority voters. 9 out of 10 ballots in apartheid election system. Okay? Maybe. Or maybe it's just Ohio. Ohio, Ohio, Ohio. And then last time was Florida, Florida, Florida. Let's talk about New Mexico. Now, in New Mexico, who am I to disagree? George Bush won the state by 5,998 votes. That's official, not counting the 34,000 votes sitting, waiting to be counted, never counted. Whose votes? One huge, big, stinking pile of spoiled votes was very red. All over New Mexico, all over Arizona, all over the West. Apparently, November 2nd, 2004, was like Indian Indecision Day. Natives all over America at the reservations and pueblos drove or took their ponies or whatever the heck, and they showed up at the polls. They waited an hour, whatever they had to do. They walked in. They walked out without choosing a president, and they went home. That's what the machines say. Who am I to disagree? That's what the machines say. Okay. So, BBC did something that, as NPR said, we don't do that. I went to the pueblos to ask these indecisive voters what was up. So, and I went to Taos Precinct 13, which is the Taos Pueblo, talked to a guy who's called, his title really is, the War Chief. And I said, okay, Chief, you Indians can't make up your mind. You don't know who to pick for president. He said, listen, white boy, we know who to pick for president, but we don't pick the voting machines. He said, they brought us new machines. And then he said something that I didn't understand. He said, we trusted them. Okay. Now, did Republicans know, and officials know, that all these black folk and brown folk would get glitched? Well, Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell wrote a letter to the and he's a Republican, who wrote a letter to the Republican head of the state Senate in Ohio before the 2000 election saying, if we don't change the bad punch card machines in the big cities, in the ghetto, we are going to have, quote, invite a Florida-like calamity, a Florida-like calamity of non-count. He wasn't warning, he was boasting. So he was the chairman of the Bush for President re-election campaign. The ACLU found out and said, change the machines before the election. And he said, no problem, sue me. They did. The election was November 2nd. They set the trial for November 10th. Okay. Don't worry about it. He's not going to be Secretary of State anymore. He's running for governor. However, he will be in office long enough to count his own votes for governor. I see you have a problem with that. Now, there's a second pile of votes uncounted in 2004, a big old pile. Because 1.3 million votes spoiled ain't enough to do it. Second pile, the provisional votes rejected. Votes rejected, mostly provisional votes. You remember that from Mrs. Gordon's class, right? We used to, you know, I ran for class president. You raise your hand, you know, count the votes, count all the hands. Well, we now know you don't count all the hands. Sorry, Jimmy, you're a provisional voter. Provisional voting? What? Where did that come? What is that? That just began. That was brand new, fresh for 2004. And it's my fault, because I did a report in 2000, in November of 2000. I discovered that just before the balloting in Florida, the presidential race, that Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush had eliminated and targeted for elimination 94,000 voters. Now, wait a minute. They were felon voters not allowed to vote. Though when we looked at the list and cracked the discs, it looks like their only crime was voting while black. Ajeb apologized. You know, he was sued after the election by the NAACP, said, I'll put all those people back on the voter rolls. I'm so sorry, but just a second, I have to return my tux from the inauguration. Then I'll put the people back. He didn't. Okay. Well, he said, next time I'll do it correctly. So, by the way, I discovered in 2004, in July, before the presidential election, Jeb Bush personally and secretly ordered a new purge of the voter rolls. When we exposed it, he said, yeah, but this time we got felons, and I got the list. In fact, my investigator, Lenny Van Eckert, stayed up 72 hours straight to go through the list to find these criminals. 60 Minutes actually contacts. You saw the report on 60 Minutes. They said, God, to go through this list, it would require, you'd have to make hundreds and hundreds of phone calls. I said, how many calls have we made? Like, hundreds and hundreds. See, again, it's amazing what you see when you look, right? Or who you speak to when you dial. Including, but we noticed some anomaly in the list, but this time they did get the right criminals, including Bernice Kynes, who was convicted of a felony on July 31st, 2009. It's most important that you eliminate the criminals of the future. You wouldn't want to give the vote to someone who's going to commit a crime. Anyway, it was all corrected. How do we get provisional? So that's why we got provisional ballots. Because, see, what happens is the Congressional Black Caucus, while when we ran a report on ABC and we offered, on BBC, we offered ABC the footage for free and they didn't run it. But the Black Caucus got a hold of a copy of the BBC report on DVD, ran it, marched into Congress, demanded that the president accept a new law which would allow voters who walk into the polls and find that they've been scrubbed and purged wrongly can demand a provisional ballot. And then they would go through and see, is this a legal voter? Is this a person that should be allowed to vote? And then they would count the vote. And when the Black Caucus made that demand, something extraordinary happened. Karl Rove said, what a great idea! Now that was a signal. And so the president signed the Help Americans Vote Act. Now, when George Bush tells us he's going to help us vote, questions arise. See, he accepted the Black Caucus's demand that every purged voter, every voter who finds their name missing from a voter roll or is challenged when they show up to vote, rare thing challenge, but if they're challenged to show up to vote, they could get a provisional ballot. But the law did not require that those ballots be counted. That would be left up to each Secretary of State, Mr. Blackwell. The caucus thought, okay, well, but at least a few thousand people will get these provisional ballots. No. November 2nd, 2004, 3 million people were shunted to provisional ballots. 3 million people got back-of-the-bus ballots, and 1,000,000 90,729 of those ballots were never counted. Just never counted. 1,090,729. Now, why so many? How do we end up with millions of people in provisional democracy? You know? How did that happen? Well, of course, as you know, and so American newspaper reporters were on the hunt, 3 million votes. How did that happen? You read about that. But it made me see, we had some questions. We had questions. How did this happen until this came through in my email box, in my inbox, at my georgewbush.org address? I have to admit something. We're working with a... See, the George W. Bush campaign is georgewbush.com. So we worked with a website called georgewbush.org. And some secretary, someone made a mistake, and on one address in several missives that were going between the state party chairman and the chief of Republican operations, Tim Griffin, at the Republican National Headquarters, one CC was changed from COM to ORG, and somehow all their email ended up in my mailbox. Careful. I should say, I was told the day before yesterday on a very important station, I won't say who it is, except that you get a mug when you donate the fund. They say, on NPR, we don't do that. I said, I know that. But I did that. I'm sorry. There were hundreds of pages like this attached to emails, and they said caging.xls, spreadsheets, caging lists, and they kept saying, here are the caging lists for, this is the new caging list, another 1,800 names, another 5,000 names, another 3,000 names. Very odd that this list of voters and addresses would go to the very top officials of the party. I'm talking the state party chairman, the Republican National Committee research chief, operations director. For one state, what we sucked down were 70,000 names. Who were these people? Team stayed up, matching the voters' addresses and their election districts with the demographics in the Census Bureau. And every single one of these names, everyone except for 2%, everyone were African American voters or African American majority precinct voters. Now, why did they have those names? Well, BBC said, you know, you don't know what you have here. No guessing. We talked to some experts who said, whoa, something extraordinary here. We haven't seen this in half a century. What was it they were seeing? Well, we decided to ask the Republican National Committee, so I flew to Washington. They slammed the door in my face. I flew to Tallahassee with our camera crew, and they sent out a spokesperson, Mindy Tucker Fletcher. I said, okay, Mindy Tucker Fletcher, what is this? And he said, donor lists. And one sheet that was all guys from the Jacksonville State Street Rescue Mission. A lot of them Bush-Cheney donors there, eh? Okay. BBC always lets you answer a question twice. They tried five or six. What was it? It was a list of voters to challenge. Now that's extraordinary. But why wouldn't they tell me that when we finally got around to challenge? I said, you're going to challenge these voters? They said, oh, these are voters we mailed first-class letters to. And the letters came back. I said, and the state party chairman got that clerical information? Why are you going to challenge these voters? Now, it's an uncomfortable question. See, because to create lists of this nature, and by the way, the other 2% of the lists were all in Jewish majority precinct retirement areas of Miami. They were targeting the elderly of Zion. But see, there's a problem with targeting Jewish or African American voters. Is that it's against the law. It's a felony. It's hard time breaking rocks on a chain gang for quite some time if you get caught doing this. And here was the entire top Republican Party structure, .com. It was the whole George W. Bush .conspiracy. Oops. Maybe. See, because you cannot target voters by ethnicity in America, even if you have a reason to suspect that their votes may be wrong. These were suspect voters that they're going to challenge on the basis that their addresses were suspect. These weren't felons this time. These were suspect addresses. So they're going to lose their vote. I'll show you this page in Armed Madhouse because it's the entire page, and there's many, many more pages, say, Naval Air Station, list after list, page after page of African American soldiers and sailors and airmen. Why were they suspect? We called their houses, and we got, for example, the wife of Randy Prousa. Where is Randy? He's under suspicion. No, he's not. He's in Baghdad. He's overseas. What the Republican Party had done in a multi-million dollar campaign, engineered by the top brass, was to send out literally millions of first-class letters marked, do not forward, return to sender. And the letters that came back, see, they used to eliminate or challenge the votes of those addressees, suspect. So they sent to black soldiers who were shipped overseas, marked do not forward. And the letters came back, and by the thousands, they were subject to challenge. 3 million voters subject to challenge and removal to the provisional ballots. Okay. And by the way, in case you're wondering, it is not against the law for a soldier under a Humvee in Fallujah to vote for President of the United States, even if they're black. Okay. 3 million votes shunted to provisional ballots, 1,090,000 not counted. Mission accomplished, Mr. President. So how'd they end up at that suspect address? I know. See, you're supposed to remind me about the plan. Because some of you conspiracy theorists, think the president had a secret plan to grab the oil fields of Iraq, control them, before the tanks rolled. And that's not true. because he had two plans. Now, the first plan came in one of those brown envelopes that I love. 101 pages long. And it included some weird stuff for, it was planning for the occupation, the economy of the occupied nation. And it had, now I went to General Garner to authenticate this document, because, you know, anyone could slip me a document. So I went to Garner and said, "You recognize this?" He said, "Oh, yeah. The plan." He said, "I know that plan." You know, he said he thought that what he was supposed to do was get the electricity turned on, get the water running, harvest the crops to avoid starvation, prevent epidemic diseases, secure the borders. Instead, he was handed a 110-page plan, which I had, which had detailed instructions for cutting income taxes on wealthy Iraqis, eliminating business taxes, expanding copyright protection so we could no longer be threatened by Baathist dubs of Britney Spears' Baby Just One More Time. It was a Christmas tree for U.S. corporations who wanted the banks, and there was the provision to sell off all the Iraqi banks, too. Privatization, the sell-off of all state assets. And it says here, privatization, asset sales, concessions, leases, and management contracts of all state assets, especially those in the oil and supporting industries, especially the oil. Sell off the oil fields. Well, there it was. Remember, as you'll see in the book, they originally called it Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL, until they did. We have the BBC tapes. OIL until Rove said, no, oif, oif, Operation Iraqi Freedom. But I want to know who came up with this plan. Copyright laws and flat tax proposals. That's it. All right. 110 pages. I smelled Grover Norquist. Now, Norquist is the capo di capi of the kind of right-wing corporate lobbyists he represented. He represented Microsoft, which wanted copyright protection expansion. He represented the super rich seeking a flat tax in the United States. He works with the Christian Coalition, the NRA, and his partners, Jack Abramoff. And I wondered if it was Grover, Jack's buddy, who came up with our plan for occupation. So I went to his K Street office, and on a sniff and a hunch, and Grover jumped out to meet me under this big, huge, wall-spanning photo of his idol with the words, "Nixon, now more than ever." Yeah. And he practically jumped over the desk to sign it. Yeah, it was his. It was his. But see, Garner didn't accept any of it. Okay. He said, "What'd you do with it? You didn't implement it." And he said, "Well, I thought Iraqis, an elected Iraqi government, should decide what to do with it." And he was removed. Paul Bremer came in, issued 100 orders, implementing absolutely everything down the line, the copyright laws, everything. except the oil. Remember, especially the oil. Something happened. Okay. But there it was, especially the oil. You know, because we kept saying, you remember, you know, the marches we had, no blood for oil, no blood for oil. Which is a very bad slogan to use, because a lot of Americans think, blood for oil, that's not a bad bargain, you know, so we'll go for that. If it's not my blood, right? It's only, you know, those suspect voters. No, something got in the way. Another plan. The one that says contents confidential. All on every page and on the cover in big letters. And which, by the way, it doesn't exist. See, because the United States Department of Defense, the United States Department of Treasury, the United States Department of State, and the Office of the White House says this document does not exist. Okay. We got the document. How? But who made up this document? I smell Baker. It's called developing a sustainable Iraqi oil industry. Now, some of you might think that the Iraqis should be developing the Iraqi oil industry, but you don't understand democracy. I smelled Baker, not Baker like bake your muffins, Baker, but James Baker III. Okay, not just any Baker. Now, James Baker III, if you don't know who he is, represents ExxonMobil Corporation. James Baker is the senior counsel for Carlyle Group. James Baker is the consigliere for the Bush family and the Republican Party. And he's also the chief lawyer on a very important case. You know, the families of the victims of September 11th sued the Saudi Arabian government. Because, you know, Zarqawi and these guys and who attack, they don't put that on their credit cards. Osama didn't put it on his credit card. The money came from Saudi Arabia. The victims' families sued the Saudi government. And Baker represents the Saudis against the victims of September 11th. And so he has an office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In the White House. This is new. A lot of people didn't. There are journalists in America who didn't believe me when I reported that he actually has an office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Even Cheney's bunker ain't at 1600. And, you know, lawyer for the Saudis, Exxon, it was a new one. And when I called the White House, they did confirm this, and they also said that, you know, that Baker actually sometimes he's the president's desk in the Oval Office while the president plays on the rug. Actually, that part I made up. But he really does have that office on Pennsylvania Avenue. But the report was not created in Washington, but rather in the nation's capital, in Houston, at the James Baker III Institute. He's an institute. Okay. Of course, maybe that didn't happen either. How do I know this, by the way? How do I get the document, identify it, and know that where it was made? I talked to the people, the oil executives that were involved in its writing, who drafted it in Houston. Of course, I just do want to warn you that they said, they never spoke to me, so in all fairness. In fact, they were quite certain, they were so certain they didn't speak to me that they called Harper's Magazine with lawyers and Baker's people and some big oil executives threatened to sue us because they didn't speak to me. And so then Lewis Lapham, the publisher, the editor, said, and which part of these audio tapes are not you? Oh. And NPR told me And NPR told me 2 days ago, we don't do that at NPR. And I said, I know that at National Petroleum Radio, you wouldn't dream of doing that. But what is it they wanted? What did the oil guys want? Grover Norquist had his list, and it's privatizing the oil fields. No. That's not how it's done. You let them pretend to own it. That's not what it's about. What it's about is this. The key of the plan is to, quote, enhance the Iraqi government's relationship with OPEC. Okay. What's that about? OPEC, okay. Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, the oil cartel. Let me repeat that, oil cartel. Okay. Now, the oil cartel, you're going to understand this, you have to understand the first two rules of the economics of oil. I'm an economist by training, okay? The lower the supply, the higher the price, rule number one. Rule number two, the lower the supply, the higher the price. Get it? So there's an oil cartel, which makes sure that the supply is low, so they set a quota, a limit, to keep the supply low, so the price will be high. Simple. It's simple, and it's illegal. Okay? It is a felony crime if they did it in the United States. In fact, it's a felony crime if any American or anyone on this planet participates under United States and international law, if anyone participates in a conspiracy to control the price and supply of a commodity. Okay? It's a felony crime, but there is the exception for guys in bathrobes and crowns. Okay? They have sovereign immunity. Okay? Now, if you're a dictator, you can do it. Okay? Now. But if... Now, who benefits? Since the war empowered OPEC, ExxonMobil Corporation's value of oil reserves has risen by two-thirds of $1 trillion. One company, $666 billion. Now, keep the price low, price high. Now remember, it's illegal. So I don't want anyone thinking that this is all kept confidential and James Baker Institute involvement and the oil company's involvement confidential, because, see, I don't want anyone thinking that the lawyers and executives for ExxonMobil were crafting a plan to help to use our 82nd Airborne to benefit and enhance an illegal oil cartel. That would be wrong. Okay. Now, of course, we still have to ask the question, how do you enhance your relationship with OPEC? How do you enhance your relationship with an oil cartel? I mean, you enhance your relationship with your wife by buying her flowers, right? You enhance your relationship with your Lord with prayer. How do you enhance a relationship with a cartel? The answer is, you cut the supply. You limit the supply. See, I know many of you are committed to the idea, as I was, that we went into Iraq, that the 101st Airborne was our oil exploration company, and that we were there to get Iraq's oil. Paul Wolfowitz promised us, in fact, remember when Wolfowitz testified before Congress and said, Iraq will be free? What he meant was, this baby ain't going to cost us a dime. Their oil, we'll bomb them there, then they'll pay us back for the bombs with their oil. Oil will be cheap. Cheap. Right? By the way, did he commit perjury? That's what a nasty question. Of course not. To commit perjury in the United States of America, his friends went, you know, were convicted. Elliot Abrams and others were convicted of perjury in the Iran-Contra. Since then, they've learned something. They don't lie under oath anymore. They don't take the oath. Paul Wolfowitz never, check it out, never raised his hand and swear to tell the whole truth. So help him, God. Now, whether God went along with that little trick, I don't know. But as far as the law is concerned, he's off. Okay. Well, check it out. We checked the transcripts. He never raised his hand. I'm not kidding. I didn't say he told the truth. I said he never raised his hand. But anyway, so what's it about? See, so I thought we went in to get the oil. No, that was as one of the old CIA's oil chief and an oil executive said, he thought my cameras are off, but my recorder was not off. He said, no, that was the sales pitch for war. That was the sales pitch for war, getting the oil. See, while they said, we're not going in for the oil, Bush is going, blood for oil, a bargain. No, it was blood for no oil. See, when the 82nd Airborne goes in as our exploration company, they go and find the oil and turn off the spigot. Thank you, Mr. Zarqawi. The lower price. The lower the supply, the higher the price. Okay? And this is a long, the idea of suppressing oil production in Iraq was not invented in Dick Cheney's bunker. Okay? You have to go back to the creation. By the way, in case you're wondering about suppression of oil in Iraq, you have to go back to the creation of Iraq, the invention of Iraq by Winston Churchill in 1920. And he started out with a bottle of brandy in one hand and a pen in the other, and he took Basra with its Shiites and the Kurds up in Kirkuk and the tar sands of Baghdad, which hold oil, which has not been drilled, and took three oil fields and made it into a country and said, you're Iraq. And then they needed a king, so Britain got Faisal. Said, Faisal of Saudi Arabia, you're king. He said, of what? Of Iraq. What's that? That's a place around Baghdad. Where's that? They took him to Baghdad, and he signed the agreement to give the entire concession for all the oil of this new oil nation to a guy named Kallust Gulbenkian, known as Mr. 5%. Kallust then flips it, as he was meant to do and supposed to do as part of the deal, to Anglo-Persian Corporation, now called British Petroleum, Standard Oil, now called Exxon, and Royal Dutch Shell, still called Royal Dutch Shell, and the French companies. And they got together on the floor of a hotel room, 1925, in Brussels, with a big map of the Arabian Peninsula. And Kallust took a red pen and made a big circle around Syria and around Iraq, and had every oil company executive sign their name on the red line on the map to agree in 1925 that they would never drill that oil. Okay? A bit of a problem, because they could lose their concession if they failed to drill the oil. And it was a big political problem. So the British ambassador wrote to Anglo-Persian, now BP, and said, my God, you got to look like you're drilling for oil. And he said, no problem. We're now drilling a whole bunch of shallow wells. And it really says this in the memorandum. Shallow wells, we are certain not to find oil. Okay. Today, Iraq has 74 oil fields. They've never had more than 15 in production. 526 oil reservoir structures, and only 125 have been drilled. And they just love it. And they're going to keep it that way, no matter how many new Zarqawis they need to do it. See, the less oil, the higher the price. Thanks, you're getting it. You know? Now, has it worked? When Bill Clinton left office, oil was $20 a barrel, cheaper than peanut butter, and now it's $73 a barrel. Mission accomplished. And what would have happened if we didn't enhance OPEC? The answer is the price would fall, and so would the House of Saud. And if the House of Saud fell, so would the House of Bush. And that's why they have to kill Hugo Chavez. Okay. I was just with President Chavez last month in Caracas. Oh, I should warn you. See the little eagle? This is from the White House. Before I went down, I read this official statement. It says that the nation is run by a demagogue awash in oil money, undermining democracy and seeking to destabilize the region. And I said, why are they mentioning Dick Cheney in this thing about South America? Turns out it says Venezuela. Venezuela. Okay. They're jealous. Okay, they're a little jealous. He got elected. You know, Chavez. Yeah. So I was talking to President Chavez about several things, including this. See this little peak thingy? This little pointed thing? It says Orinoco Extra Heavy Oil Resources. It's from inside the Department of Energy. And the Department of Energy called BBC and said, where did you get that? And we said, we can't remember. What it says is that Hugo Chavez, or underneath Venezuela, which means underneath Hugo Chavez, is more oil than in the entire Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Like, a lot more oil now. That's a problem. See, well, you say, well, we need oil. But remember I told you, less oil, higher price. Okay. What would Chavez do with the oil? Now, why not just switch? See, it's heavy oil. But once the price of oil starts rising over $30 a barrel, I mean, it's a little more expensive to pull up. Suddenly all this oil is available. But it's under Hugo Chavez. So what's the big deal? The big deal is this. Think of our president whirling around, chauffeuring around King Abdullah, the guy in the bathrobe and the crown, the dictator, right? Why is he taking him around on that golf cart on the Crawford Ranch? Well, first of all, because George is afraid of horses. And that's true, okay? BBC, we looked all over a picture. He's a rancher for a picture of a guy on a horse. We found one, and the horse was dead. It was stuffed. If you pull back from the picture of George on the horse, it's like a, you know, set-up horse. Of course, there may be a rocking horse or something, but other than that, there's no picture. He's afraid of horses. But why is he going around? Do we need Abdullah's oil? No. We don't need Abdullah's oil. I mean, what's he going to do with it? He can't drink it. His harem can't drink it. He's got to sell it to us. The answer is we don't need petroleum from Abdullah. George Bush is addicted to his petrodollars. Remember the film Network? A truth-telling TV journalist says, this system's got to end. And a big mogul
pulls him into a conference room and says, "Mr. Beale, the Arabs have taken billions of dollars from us, and now we must get it back. It goes out. It must come in. It goes out again, and it comes in. It's the ebb and flow. There are no nations. There are no flags. There's only the ebb and flow. There is only DuPont and Exxon and Royal Dutch Shell, and the money goes out and it comes back in." Until Chavez came along. See. What happens is, we get taxed. You know, we talk about the high European gasoline taxes. We have a high Saudi Exxon gas tax collected by Exxon at the pump. They take a big slice. They're clearing $10 billion clear profit every 3 months. No one's seen profit like that since, you know, the pharaohs, right? They take their slice. The rest goes out to the Emirates and the Arabian Peninsula. Abdullah takes a little slice for his next Rolls Royce, and most of it, almost all of it, comes back, flows back in, a little in various ways, like to buy our ports, but mostly just straight up to buy the treasury bills and treasury bonds for George, so that George can fund his spending spree for oil wars and war toys and tax cuts for the very, very rich. As he says, his kind of people, the haves and the have-mores, right? And the presidency has run up a new debt owed by America, has run it up by $2 trillion. He says, stone sober, $2 trillion, and 100% of it has been borrowed from abroad, the keystone being the petrodollars. See, here's the deal. We lend Abdullah, or he lends us $1 trillion. We lend him the 82nd Airborne to stay in power. That's a good deal. But despite the Quranic prohibition on charging interest, he's very good at collecting his pound of flesh. Our real interest rates are so high. Don't believe the hype that General Motors is going down. I remember in the Valley when there used to be the Chevy plant in Van Nuys. Don't believe it went down because, God forbid, auto workers want health insurance after they retire. It's because the interest burden of General Motors has gone up 500% so that it will flow back in, okay? For the flow, right? And those jobs are dying, and they love it. So $253 billion went out last year, quarter of a trillion, and a third of a trillion came back. The ebb and flow. But Hugo said something to me. See this? Now they gotta go to Hugo. And here's what he said to me. He didn't say he was going to squeeze us. He said, "I will give America oil one-third less than you're paying now. I'll cut the price. I'll take a buck off a gallon of gas, okay? I want a couple things, though. Peace, stability, price going up and down that the Saudis' game of running the price up and down, it's ruining my economy with boom and bust, and it's destroying America. I know that your heating bills, your poor people can't take it. So let's work it out between our peoples." And Bill Clinton, by the way, who I have a lot of nasty things to say about, but he shook Hugo Chavez's hand on this, and then George Bush's spit on his hand, and his reaction, you'd think George Bush would go down and, like, say, a third off oil, a buck a gallon off? You know, I mean, man, what do you want, Hugo? I'll wash your car with my tongue. You know, no, the ebb and flow, right? No, our president's response was delivered through his spiritual advisor,
the Reverend Pat Robertson, who said, "Hugo Chavez thinks we're trying to kill him, and I think we should just go ahead and do it." The in and out. See, because Chavez said, I will give you the oil cheaply, but the money, the petrodollars, stay here in Venezuela. Take a look around, Greg. Take a look around. I'd been there years before. 1 million cardboard shacks surrounding Caracas. 1 million cardboard shacks. Now there are houses made out of bricks with computers inside. He says, now the money's going to stay there to pay for that. And to make a point, he said, you know, we can't be an oil colony anymore, and neither should you be. Okay. And to make his point, he took $20 billion out of the United States Federal Reserve and lent it to Argentina and Ecuador. So now he's got a date with a bullet. So now, what are you going to do about it? Okay, I told you that they took 3.5 million votes. Okay. I told you where the next, and not only that, they took 1.9 million, almost 2 million votes in 2000, cast not counted. With the provisionals and the gimmicks, they pumped it up to 3.5 million votes not counted in 2004. In 2008, count on it, what they're not counting. 5 million votes with the new voter ID. And you know Mr. Rodriguez, who's going to be asked for their ID. Right? You know it. 5 million votes will be cast and not counted. So what are you going to do about it? Well, I got together with Martin Luther King and the Third and other civil rights leaders in Birmingham. And King said, "Greg, I'm going to take your book and put it on my father's grave. And I know he'll be pleased." He really said that. Well, wait. I didn't applaud. I said, I was moved. I, you know, who wouldn't be? But then I said, "You're just going to get the book dirty. And there's got to be a better idea." And Jesse Jackson said, "Greg, we march, we win." Why don't we march down Pennsylvania Avenue, throw the book through the window into James Baker's office? You know, he said, "No, we march, we win," is what Jackson said. I know that might not seem too imaginative or original. I'm sorry. It's never imaginative or original. Okay? He said, "I know this. If we don't march, we don't win. We lose." He said, "We didn't have the vote in 1964 when we crossed the bridge in Birmingham. And then we marched and we got the vote. We didn't have the peace here in Los Angeles in 1967 when KPFK was reporting the cops beating up the kids. When Lyndon Johnson came to the Century City Plaza, that's how I became a member of KPFK. Okay. Now, we didn't have the peace. We marched and we won the peace. We marched and we went to jail and won the peace. Okay. We march, we win. And we vote. I know it's dull. Sorry. It's that simple. That's just part of it. Just part of it. And why bother, right? Everyone says, "They're going to steal the vote anyway. Just why bother?" Okay. I mean, I was the guy asking that question. And then the answer came to me from the guys in Taos Precinct 13 in the Pueblo. They can't vote. Their vote won't count. Okay? Every single morning, and just so you know, if you're a Native American, most Native Americans end up as suspect voters. That is, they end up in the military. Natives go into the service. Okay? There's a lot of them. Their kids are there, right? And all the guys there are veterans. And every morning, the Pueblo natives of Taos raise the American flag
every single morning, and they salute it. And say, my God, why? You know, they say, well, they take our land. They take our resources. They take our kids away to their wars. But we'll be damned if they're going to take away our flag and our country. And you're not going to let them take it away because their votes won't count, so your vote has to count for them. In 2000, they took 2 million votes. In 2004, they took 3.5 million votes. In 2008, they're going to take 5 million votes. So you're going to bring 6 million new voters to the polls. That's what you're committing to tonight. That's why you're committing to this tonight. And when they, if they keep 140,000 of our kids and suspect voters in Baghdad, you're going to keep 140,000 people in the streets in this city and every city in America. That's our job now. And the only advice I can give you is advice I got from George Bush. Yeah. In March of 2003, 2 days before the tanks rolled, he said, I want to talk to the Iraqi people. You know, they speak Arabic, but then never mind. He said, our president, do not fight for a dying regime. It is not worth your life. Thank you very much. Okay. I think we're going to take 3 or 4 questions, and that's it. Maybe 3 questions, and then I'll answer any further questions out there. I will stay and sign any books that any of you want to get, and I won't leave until everyone is thanked personally for supporting this great station.
Until
PFK.
Greg Palast.
Jerry Quigley.
Can you take your seat? And don't approach the stage yet. We are there's going to be a book signing, and we're actually going to read some questions that came from the audience. There'll be a book signing. If you are here to have your book signed, please line up on this side of the church and don't clog up the middle aisle. Let me see this first question. None of these are signed. Greg, I have
I
the
feel
same.
Feel like the Lord up here.
I have.
Lordish.
I have the same dream every night. I'm naked in an elevator full of people. I get off on the 40th floor of the Exxon building, walk into the conference room, and it is only one person there, George Bush. And he's doing something really, really inappropriate to a Cabbage Patch doll. He then says, next. What does this mean, Greg?
God, I've had the same experience. Okay.
All right. From an international viewpoint, how distorted is the news Americans are receiving?
What news are you receiving? Other than KBFK, your weapon of mass destruction. I mean, my reports just bounce off the electronic Berlin Wall. I want you to know that armed madhouse, that it is the number one selling political book in America, not Ann Coulter's book. And I am on, you know how many TV stations I've been on? Yeah, exactly. None. Okay, it's not about me. Asia Week said the number one investigative reporter in the United States of America is persona non grata in America's newsrooms. But it's not Greg Palast, which is persona non grata. It's the information, okay? It's the information. It's the list of suspect voters. It's Plan A and Plan B. It's Hugo Chavez's oil. That's information non grata. And I have to lob it over the water from BBC television. You know, I mean, my kids are getting upstairs, downstairs accents, man. This is like gotta end.
And we're going to end it now. The omerta is over. Okay.
Last I heard, the investigation into voting irregularities had discovered how easy voting machines could be hacked. Are there any new developments or outcomes?
Are there new developments and outcomes? There sure are. I have a document here. I seem to always have a document. It's like Joe McCarthy. I have a document here, except unlike McCarthy, I have the document, see? This was a setup, right? I actually happened to have this with me. Slipped out the back door from a voting machine company when I was in New Mexico. Are the total tabulations from the central tabulators. Now, this is proprietary. It's a private company. It's a commercial secret. All our votes go into these central computers of contractor companies, and we always hope that our vote influences their decision on who wins the race. And someone slipped this out to me because they wanted me to note something that worked inside one of these companies. And you see, in Precinct 5 in this county, you've got for President and Vice President Kerry, and you have Kerry, Bush, Cobb, Nader, the votes. And then in the Precinct 11, Kerry, Bush, Cobb, Nader, the total of votes. And in the Precinct 9B, you have Bush, Cobb, Nader. Where's John? Selected precincts in New Mexico. Bush won, though, by 5,998 votes. Selected precincts in New Mexico, where simply Kerry's name is. So it's not just votes that disappear, it's candidates. That's the new development. Final question, and then I'll talk to you back there.
Final question is, did George Bush beat you out for a woman or something? Why do you hate him? That's inappropriate, because you overwrote this question. And you don't know, Bush or Greg, either could be gay, and you shouldn't even assume heterosexuality. Okay, that's wrong. We're all in this together. All right, ignore that question, neophyte. The final question, what's up with MP George Galloway?
What's up? I don't know.
A little curveball, non sequitur.
He hasn't called me lately. I'll take one more. I don't know he's.
Well, all right, I'll try to. Then how long before the euro overtakes the dollar as the world's major currency? Too late.
Too late. Yeah, it's happened. In fact, no one has worked harder to make sure the euro takes over the dollar than George Bush. See, I hate to give you that. Why am I the guy that has to bring you this information? Come on. Get John Pilger up here to do it. Something, you know. Amy, help me out. Yeah. Here's how it works, man. Remember our president got up in front of TV cameras and he said, I've gotten the Chinese government to revalue the yuan. And all the newspapers said, that's brilliant. George Bush is an economic genius. He is forcing the Chinese to revalue the yuan, and not one single reporter had any freaking idea what that meant. They don't know what that meant. What's the yuan? What does revaluing it mean? It means that George Bush just said, I have devalued the dollar. I have reduced the value of your pensions. I have devalued your savings and your life's work. I have now raising interest rates, and I'm sending your jobs to a land with fewer unions that are going to raise any trouble, where there are no suspect voters because there are no voters. So believe me, if there's anyone who has sank the USS Dollar, the big torpedo is named Bush. Okay, thank you very, very much. I'll answer your questions.
Let's hear it one time for Mr. Greg Palast. There's going to be a line to have your book signed. Please line up on the left hand, on this side of the church. And please don't block out the middle aisle. And please be kind enough to let Greg get to where he's signing books. And if you have a question or comment for him, you can ask him at the book signing table. Thank you all so much for coming.